This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Hello, everyone. A lot of you know me as a podcaster and a YouTube host, but you may not know that I have been a long-time outdoor writer and hunter. And I don't just talk about rifles and guns and bullets. I've been there. To a large degree, I started way back in 1966 when I got my first legal hunting license as a lad. But prior to that, we were hunting with bows and arrows and BB guns and pretty much anything we could get on the farm. So I just thought to establish my bona fides with some of you and let you know that I really do hunt, I would read to you one of the old stories that I'd written on one of my adventure hunts, this one for a big brown bear. Since this is bear month and we're focusing on bears and bear attacks and bear defense tools and hunting rifles and all the rest of it. So without further ado, this is my story on a Kamchatka brown bear hunt. Now, Kamchatka is a peninsula hanging off of the eastern coast of Russia, a long, long ways away. And for most of my life, Americans were not allowed there. Petropavlovsk, the largest town on this big peninsula, was the submarine base for the Soviet military. Highly secret. But after the Soviet Empire collapsed in, I think it was 1990, the perestroika sort of opened everything up, and suddenly hunters were allowed to go there, and big brown bears were the attraction. Brown bears had been hunted on Kamchatka for longer than anyone can remember, prehistory. The local native peoples hunted them, revered them, actually, because I suspect, as most primitive peoples do when they find game, they are pretty honored to have taken it because it's going to feed the tribe. So they did their hunting with a lot of respect for the animals. They wouldn't say they necessarily worshiped them, but it may be open to interpretation. But boy, they made a big deal, a big ceremony about their bear hunting. We don't do that quite as much now, but boy, I tell you what, I was sure appreciative of the opportunity to see this remarkable volcanic landscape and wilderness and hunt bears there. So let's read the story, Kamchatka Brown Bear Hunt. First, you have to really want to hunt a brown bear. Second, you have to really love to travel 73 hours from home to hunting camp. Third, you must enjoy 7 consecutive days of snowfall. Fourth, you must be prepared to wallow through 9 days of melting snows that flood rivers and limit travel to snow machine, snowshoes, skis, and boots. Fifth, you must tolerate 10 days largely confined to tents, a cooking shack buried to the ridgeline in snow, and a pit toilet where old newspapers were the only papers. If you can handle all of this, you will get to enjoy a wood-fired sauna, 3 square meals of local cuisine a day, all the tea you can drink, a host of hardworking, friendly, and joyous Russian guides, and ice fishing for char. And it will all happen amid silence so deep you can literally hear snow falling on birches. And you'll see brown bears in their late winter wonderland. Big brown bears. More brown bears per square mile than anywhere else on Earth. All of this in one of the greatest wildernesses left in the world, Kamchatka. "He's big, da, big medved," Sasha hissed. I recognized the Russian word for bear. The morning's sunny skies had clouded over. The frozen snow had softened. Our ancient snow machine had already bogged several times. We ourselves were sinking up to our waists in what was rapidly becoming impassable snowfields. Snowfields that stretched horizon to horizon across broad valleys, through expansive birch forests, up naked mountain peaks, and into the sky. It was a world of white sagging. Spring-bound bear hunting is notorious for fickle weather. In this case, fickle is spelled B-A-D. Windy, cloudy, rainy, with a chance of deluges. Land that supports brown bears supports salmon, and salmon grow where water flows in abundance. That flow starts as rain and snow. Our yellow tents sat atop 10 feet of crystallized water, and by the looks of the sky, we were about to be buried under a few more feet. Sasha glared at that sky. He shook his head gravely, and he spread his fingers again across the fresh tracks that we'd been following. The front pad was more than 7 inches across. "Big," my guide repeated. "Big, go shoot." He nodded toward the declivity into which we'd seen the boar walk. But how big? This was the 5th bear we'd seen, not counting the 9 that we'd spotted during our helicopter flight into camp. And we'd already turned away from a boar that Sasha had called an 8.5-footer. That suggested that this one might be 9 feet. Or bigger? Or, given that ominous sky, smaller? Could my guide, a lifelong resident of this isolated peninsula in far eastern Russia, could he know that the weather was closing in, that conditions would worsen and make hunting almost impossible? Or was he simply eager to finish early and spend his time in camp? Like most hunters, I didn't want to shoot too early, nor too small of an animal, but neither did I want to miss out on what might be my only chance to take a Russian brown bear. It isn't every day one gets invited to hunt Kamchatka, let alone Kamchatka brown bears. In fact, it took 57 years for Dakota Arms and Swarovski Optics to invite me on such a hunt. I figured I couldn't afford to wait another 57 years. Of course, the invitation came with strings attached. In return for the privilege of hunting one of the most coveted brown bear districts in the universe, I was expected to test Dakota and Swarovski products and write about them. Specifically, I was to carry and shoot a precisely made, controlled round feed Model 97 bolt action rifle wrapped in a lovely quarter sawn AA French walnut stock. I was further expected to aim that rifle with Swarovski's brilliant groundbreaking 1.7 to 10 by 42 millimeter Z6 scope. I raised my right hand and I faithfully swore to fulfill those duties. While test firing in the deserts of Idaho, I discovered that the classic style 375 H&H would regularly plant 3 Remington Premier 300 grain Swift A-frame loads into a circle stretching 1.2 to 1.6 inches at 100 yards. I figured that was suitable for not only hitting an 8 to 10 foot, 800 pound animal, but hitting it in a vital spot, like high on the shoulder. That's always a good bet on any bear. Miss by several inches in any direction and you will break the spine or puncture the lungs, destroy the heart, or break one or both front legs. It's a high percentage shot. And done right, it's an anchoring shot. Lights out. But first you have to find that bear. Even in the brown bear capital of the world, that isn't always easy. To the average U.S. citizen, Kamchatka is known, if it's recognized at all, as the home of the old Soviet Union's Pacific Submarine Fleet stationed in Petropavlovsk. Prior to the installation of this military base, this peninsula of volcanic mountains dangling like a milk cow's teat off the southwest coast of Siberia was virtually devoid of humans. Natives eked out their livings on salmon and native game, much as did their cousins in Alaska. Russian sailors and sealers joined them beginning late in the 18th century, lured by a wealth of furs. Exploitation of natural resources continued its usual course, but once the fur rush ended, Kamchatka slipped back into relative obscurity. This became a forced isolation once the Soviets threw their harsh blanket of Cold War secrecy over that peninsula. For 70 years, Kamchatka's bears bred, fed, and grew unseen and largely unsuspected by sport hunters. For native hunters, however, brown bears continued to be a feared and respected predator and prey. Given their abundance and size, they were an essential part of the native Kamchatkans' lives. After killing a bear, the Koryak people placed before its skull platters of puddings and meat for its journey home. Women donned the bear's hide and they danced, entreating the bear to speak kindly of the people and to invite other bears to give themselves up. Then they feasted on its flesh. Limited to spears and bows, the Koryak nevertheless had an advantage over modern firearms hunters. Time. Weeks of rain, fog, and snow were nothing to a people hunting their backyards. They faced no self-imposed time constraints. They didn't need to catch prearranged helicopter rides. We, on the other hand, had 9 days. We had to fight the weather, fight the snow, fight the clock, force the issue. Under clear skies and sub-freezing temperatures, 9 days would be a surefit of time. A snow machine glides like smoke over frozen snow, taking you over 50 miles of mountain valleys and ridges each day, dropping you at glassing points where an 8X binocular will reveal hulking brown bears 4 miles away. A 20 to 60 spotting scope will pull them into your circle of influence from 10 miles. You see their sleepy heads poke from snowy dens halfway up rocky peaks. You follow the blue shadows of their trails down ridges, across valleys, and right into the black, leathery pads that laid them. That's the way it happened our first day, a day that lulled us into believing we could continue this easy path all week, cruising and snooping, picking and choosing. "There's a bear peeking out of that den," my hunting partner Linda Powell said when we stopped beside her and her guide high up a mountain valley. The bear was even higher. "Misha saw its head duck down. I thought it was just a rock. Oh, there it goes. Oh, it looks big. How big is it?" The dark bear sauntered off, angling ever higher up its mountain, unsettled by these noisy morning visitors far below. Linda turned to Misha, her guide, with a questioning look, then took out her cheat sheet, a card with dimensions written on it in centimeters and feet. Misha's thick forefinger flicked between the 8.5-foot and 9.5-foot numbers. Sasha waved me back onto his ancient snow machine. We looped up the valley, parked behind a shoulder of mountain, and began hiking up that hard snow. It was like walking on asphalt. The air was thin, but not as thin as our chances for catching up with this bear. Despite angling to cut it off, we broke over the shoulder to find our quarry already high above us, ambling along, but covering ground as we never could. It reminded me of caribou. You don't walk down caribou. And apparently, you don't walk down climbing Russian bears either. Sasha waved at the bear in surrender. We studied his tracks, probably an 8.5-footer, not big enough for the first morning anyway. Bear tracks and trails crisscrossed this May winter wonderland. Our quarry was obviously awake and prowling, and neither terrain nor habitat seemed to have any effect on those travels. The spoor laid up and down sheep steep slopes, over the highest ridges, through the thickest birch forests, across frozen rivers. If the bears hoped to find food, they would be disappointed. We saw no sign of moose or caribou. The early rising boars were probably hoping to find spring romance. The early boar gets the sow, and possibly a tasty cub. There was little else alive atop that snow. White hares with jet black ear tips sprang from the bases of birch trunks and dashed away. Ptarmigan fluttered white and brown. A few red-combed males strutted and complained when we interrupted their posing. fox tracks lined across valleys as if their makers had somewhere to go. Our second bear looked and behaved much like the first. It, too, crawled from a den hole high among the cliffs where protrusions of dark rock provided surprisingly effective camouflage for a brown head. We didn't even see it until, unnerved by our quiet presence in the valley, it crawled out of its winter's lodging. In what must be this species' universal escape tactic, it climbed up and over the snowy peak. We guessed that one at 9 feet. We guessed we'd never catch up. We guessed we'd have many more chances, many more bears, but we failed to guess that the weather would sour. Nights in camp were celebrations in the tar paper cook shack with its birch-burning stove crackling a hearty warmth, while Oksana ladled steaming bowls of soup and spread the table with plates of cucumbers and tomatoes grown in geothermal greenhouses on the peninsula. There were freshly baked breads and meatballs wrapped in dumplings, fresh char, ham, wine, and after dinner, noisy celebrations with vodka. Our hosts sang Beatles tunes and recited poetry. We responded with old rock songs and toasted our talents with more vodka. The first sound each morning was a woodpecker rat-a-tatting its territorial drum roll from the birch grove across the creek. It was a lonely solo broken rarely by croaking ravens, once by a passing gull, a reminder that the sea wasn't far away. A coterie of Siberian tits, cousins to our chickadees, sparked life into the bare branches now and then, but mostly the land lay hushed, as if holding its breath, as if it were husbanding its last reserves for the great burst of spring. One morning, a big, nearly black bear climbed steadily up a mountain behind camp and disappeared over the top. Late that afternoon, it struggled back, looking discouraged, sinking past its belly in the melting snow. My bear appeared shortly after we'd crossed a confusing maze of tracks to a sow and cub. They seemed nervous. Big tracks circled them in the snow. I thought of a hungry boar, and I suspect Sasha did too. While puzzling out that spoor, we glimpsed a large, dark bear walking near the edge of the distant trees. That was all Sasha needed to see. Bolshoi! Big! Big boar! Go! Shoot! The snow was soft, deep, exhausting. It was starting to snow. The tracks were big. It was time to shoot. I popped the cover from the scope and I snicked around into the chamber. The bear emerged from a dip in the snow, stopped, squinted, or at least it looked as if it were squinting, right at us. I looked at my guide one more time for confirmation. Shoot this bear? He nodded vigorously. The bear began loping left to right. I thought I'd let him stop, but he showed no inclination to do that. The wind was in our favor, but he'd apparently seen or heard enough. The scope was set on 3X, just in case. I swung it just to the front edge of his shoulder and fired. The boar dropped in its tracks, kicking feebly. I put one more 300-grain A-frame in its brisket, angling up toward the spine, but it was superfluous. That first bullet had broken the shoulder, clipped the spine, and lacerated the lungs. In seconds, the bear lay still, lying big and dark in a vast white world of sagging snow with more on the way. Now, here are sidebars that went along with that article. Dakota is back as Park West Arms. Having grown up and learned to hunt in South Dakota, I have always had a soft spot for Dakota rifles, but I'd like them just as much if they were called Montana or even New York rifles. A rose is a rose, and a rifle as sweet as the Dakota Model 97 in classic quarter sawn walnut matched to a blued 375 H&H barreled action can play in my garden in any season. Dakota fell on confusing times with new owners late in the 20th century. Remington brought financial stability for a few short years, but then it too folded. Most recently, Dakota emerged under a new name, Park West Arms. Same rifles, many of the same builders, same or better quality, they just aren't allowed to use the Dakota name anymore. The Model 97, now the SD97, is a less expensive alternative to the original Model 76. The main difference is the action body. In the SD97, it is round-bottomed like the Remington Model 700. The SD76 mounts to stocks with a flat-bottomed action, like the Winchester Model 70. The long spring external claw extractor and Mauser-style controlled round feed action with its three-position wing safety is the same on both rifles. Most SD97s are probably sold with a synthetic stock, but you can get the deluxe with quarter-sawn AAA Clara Walnut handle if you want. Mine shows a classic glowing and understated elegance, and of course, it balances, handles, and shoots as good as it looks for about $800 less than a similar SD76. The fit and finish are superb, the hand-rubbed oil finish is silky, and the overall feel of that rifle is delicious. Swarovski is, well, Swarovski. What can you say about Swarovski scopes that isn't said in the name alone? There's no question of the quality and the performance. The Z6 series broke new ground with this 6x zoom ratio, and the 1:7:10 power by 42mm objective may be the most useful and versatile of that series, especially on a 375 H&H. At the low end, you can quickly pick up the closest, angriest buffalo jumping from the long grass, and at 10x, you can reach out and pinpoint the smallest long-range antelope. The 375 H&H's trajectory is nearly identical to the 30-06, making it quite viable to 300-350 yards. It's truly one of the world's most versatile cartridges, and the 1.7-10x Z6 Swarovski helps it reach its full potential. Amazingly, this Z6, despite its increased zoom range, is slightly shorter and just 7 ounces heavier than Swarovski's 1.5-6 by 42mm. Well, that is how I wrote up the adventure. But what I didn't get to write, of course, are all sorts of details that not every magazine writer or reader wants to see. And I thought maybe I'd share some of that with you. I had mentioned the 73 hours of travel. Here's what happened. I was starting off in Idaho, and I thought, well, that's not very far to skip across the Pacific to Kamchatka Peninsula. But you couldn't go that way. There used to be flights, would go to Anchorage and then across, and I think once even Seattle and across. But when this hunt came down, they had shut those flights off, and we had to go to New York to Moscow, all the way across Siberia, an 8-hour flight across Siberia. That was a long one. And then we're at Petropavlovsk, landing at the old military base with military jets still out on the edges of the runways. Didn't see any of their submarines because we weren't close enough to the water. But then we had to load up in a van and head north on what became pretty primitive roads pretty quickly. I jokingly refer to them not as gravel roads with potholes, but as potholes with remnants of gravel road around them. It was slow and bumpy, and so slow that we had to stop for the evening at a little, I call it a rural small town village hotel, which was essentially a house with some rooms you could sleep in and a little kitchen that would serve you borscht, some bread and butter, borscht and more borscht, and a cookie for dessert. But I mean, this is what adventures are all about. Different cultures, different places. And it's not that much different from a lot of the hunting grounds I've traveled to in North America, especially back in the 60s and 70s when I was younger. I can remember ending up in some pretty primitive hotels in northern South Dakota. I could have sworn I was going to find Lewis and Clark 1805 written on the wall or something. But part of the adventure up here, and what we noticed in these small villages, were that the people were dressed to the nines. It was really unusual. Women would be pushing their babies in prams across these muddy, rutted streets. They would have high heels on and clothes that looked like it came out from a Paris or an Italian designer or something. And yet many of the buildings, if not most, were pretty run down. And we were told by our Russian interpreter that's because the local people could own their clothing and their personal effects, but the government's always owned the building. The housings and stuff were owned by the government. So it's like, why put my money and efforts into fixing that up? But they were always friendly people by and large once you met them. And they worked well and hard for us. We just felt safe and comfortable the whole time. Fortunately, we had a Russian guide who spoke excellent English, and he could not only interpret for us, but explain things that you don't normally get from a simple interpretation. And we stopped at a few shops along the way, and they were pretty nicely stocked with the basics and Coca-Cola. A lot of American products were in there as well. And then when we reached kind of the end of the road, we hit a river that was mostly frozen. There were still some people out there ice fishing, but they were starting to open up, looking a little bit hairy. And we were not about to drive across it. So we waited for our next leg of the journey, which was a helicopter. Those big, I think they're Sikorskis, those big orange double chopper helicopters the Russians flew around. That's what came in overhead, landed on that gravel road, throwing up gravel and leaves and quite the mess. And that's what we loaded all of our gear into, along with some 50-gallon drums for fuel, supplying people along the way, I guess. And then we took off across the river, landed very quickly, and fueled up at a fuel station, and then took off and flew for, I believe it was an hour and a half, possibly 2 hours, across just this incredible wilderness with volcanic peaks on all sides of us, some of them still smoking, still active, with the snows melted off because they were so hot. And then right beside it would be another one that was white and covered with snow because it was sleeping. So it was quite the ring of fire. That whole area is like Alaska. It's that Pacific ring of fire where all the volcanoes come up. We continued flying north until we finally got to a narrow portion of the Kamchatka Peninsula where our camp was. And then we landed in the snow, deep snow, and that helicopter sank right to its belly. But they've got a big, wide belly, and it was able to hold everything up just fine. They opened up the back and unloaded all the gear. And then we hopped on snowmobiles and we raced over through the woods to the camp. And we could just see the roof sticking out of the snow. Now, that was the cook shack. And there was another tiny little roof sticking out. That was the outhouse. And then there were a couple of yellow tents, home sweet home. Oh, there was a little sauna down by the creek too. And that was a lifesaver. Didn't have a shower, but by golly, you could get in there and get nice and hot and then roll in the snow and get cleaned up. We did plenty of that. And then after that, it was just get to know our hosts. And again, we had that good interpreter, but some of the guides could speak a little bit of English. And they were really friendly, as I mentioned in the story. At supper, we would get pretty happy with a couple of vodkas, and then we'd start singing, or they would start singing. They could, a couple of them were really pretty good. And one of them loved to sing Elvis and Engelbert Humperdinck. And he could really belt it out. So we all got together and sang some American rock songs that they pretty much knew, too. They were pretty up on the American culture. So we had some good times. Now, we went fishing, I believe, the second day it started raining, and the snow was just bogging down the snow machines and stuff. So they thought, hey, we got plenty of time. Let's let the weather clear up, and we'll go catch some fish. What we didn't quite understand was that they wanted to catch some fish so they could feed us. They were going to run out of food, and they did. But we caught a whole heap of fish. And I tell you, the ice was starting to go out on that river too, but there were some areas where it was slow enough that you could walk safely out there. Caught a hole in ice fish, and we were catching char. And Linda was really catching the big ones too. But we caught a pile of char and thought we were having a blast, and we did have a blast, including char the first night and even the second day. Not so much the third day, and pretty inedible by the fourth day. And by the fifth day, we just push it away. We didn't even try it because it wasn't frozen. It was hanging up outdoors, and it was supposed to dry, but it was raining and snowing so much that it didn't dry, and it got to be pretty old fish. But boy, that was pretty tasty the first couple of times. So we went on like that in the camp and just had a great time. The weather really was tough. It was just snow and rain and melt, and it was tough to get around in the old snow machines. And they had some old snow machines, single skis up front. Mostly the cowls were off so they could repair them quickly and often, and they did. Sometimes they would spread a blanket out in the snow and tear the carburetor apart and rebuild it right in front of your eyes, and it was pretty crazy. But they maintained a happy attitude the whole time, and we tried our best to do the same, enjoyed what the situation was, and had ourselves just one heck of an adventure. So here's hoping you can have similar adventures. I don't know if I want to wish upon you 7 days of rain and snow and melting, but hey, learn to roll with the punches and enjoy what's handed out, because you only go around once, and you've got to go for the gusto. Hey, this is Ron Spomber. Thanks for listening, guys. Let me know if you enjoy these kinds of stories. I'll throw one out every once in a while if you do. Until next time, hunt honest and shoot straight.